Thanks a lot. Okay, so here is a quick summary of what I plan to talk about. Some of you have heard the renormalization of Hamiltonians and related stuff already n plus one times, so I figured I'll tell more about how one uses this to construct invariant tori, and so this includes smooth tori and also non-smooth tori. So this involves several steps, and I'm just going to say a few things about each one. That's basically it. So I'll start with not really critical Hamiltonians, but maybe some notation. Now, the results about, probably the most flashy result here will be the existence of Hamiltonians with a non-differentiable invariant, golden invariant tori. But this is like a year plus epsilon old already, so I'm including a little bit some of the things I'm telling in a larger context of vector fields that need not necessarily be Hamiltonian, and this is like joint work in progress with Sasha Koksic, who is also here. Okay, but this is more some auxiliary steps at the moment. Okay, now I got these transparencies that you can almost not separate from the paper. Okay, so just to fix some notation, so all a vector field here is a vector field on the torus times some RL, where the L may not necessarily be the same as the dimension of the torus. The flows will be the psi's. And an invariant torus will be actually, by that I mean the conjugacy, not the manifold, but the conjugacy with the linear flow. So this is a linear flow for just on the Hamiltonian with some frequency vector omega. And the torus gamma, indexed by the vector field, is just some semi-conjugacy between this linear flow and the actual flow on the graph of gamma. And I'm going to switch back and forth, but usually I'll talk about Hamiltonians, so the vector field is simply given by this. And a very trivial example, which I'll use often, is that letter K is just a trivial Hamiltonian, which is basically a linear flow whose frequency may depend on where you are in the p variables. And so, for example, if p is equal 0, we in fact have this flow here, and this is in fact the trivial flow for this particular trivial Hamiltonian. And there will be, of course, conditions on omega, but at this point there isn't any. So here I just recall quickly, just for the fun of it, KM theorem, that if you're close to that trivial Hamiltonian and you omega satisfies some Diophantine condition or less restrictive condition and M is non-degenerate, then every Hamiltonian nearby has some invariant torus gamma in the sense I described before. Now, the proof is very constructive, and I'm just putting it here, two aspects for comparison with renormalization. So basically, constructing invariant tori is done through a sequence of changes of variables. Some people tend to think, well, it's all just changes of variables, but in fact, we have been talking now for a whole week basically about changes of variables. That's what the whole thing is about. So here we have a sequence of changes of variables that in fact the Hamiltonian under these changes of variables goes to trivial, but the thing is that it goes to trivial on a shrinking and shrinking domain. So what's typically left over is very thin, just basically one torus, and in fact the torus would then be this one here. So renormalization attempts to do something similar with some differences. So for example, one tries to avoid that this tends to zero or to converges on a shrinking domain. That's mainly the main difference. So there will be sandwiched between each of these U's here will be some other change of variable that's not homotopic to the identity that prevents this from the domain shrinking to zero. But more importantly, of course, the whole thing wasn't motivated by trying to prove a theorem that Moser already did 30 years ago, but to describe something that I'm going to show next, which is critical behavior. But before I do this, here is my transparency that belongs in all my talks. This is the standard orbits close to integrable. This is by Alex Haro, a picture for the standard map. So here you see, here is after a small perturbation of the trivial Hamiltonian K in a return map, you see it still looks pretty integrable here. So I'm talking next about the situation where the perturbation increases and this thing islands form all over the place, and this torus somehow has to ship around all those, and without deforming this is not really possible, and eventually it just can't do this anymore and gives up and breaks up, and that's when it gets interesting. So here is a one-page description of this whole phenomenon. I'm trying to make it short because, again, I don't really want to tell things that you have already heard n plus one time. So it's about the golden mean, the case that I'm going to talk about. So the golden mean is related to this matrix or vice versa. So to get the best Diophantine approximant to the golden mean, you just take this matrix C and iterate it on, let's say, this vector here, and you get the ratios of the components, get the best approximants to the inverse of the golden mean. So what will play a role when you discuss a golden mean invariant tori is this matrix T or something similar to it, and this eigenvector omega where everything converges to eventually. And if you want to make observations yourself, you can take, for example, this one parameter family of Hamiltonian. That's basically the same that Escond and Dovey were using 25 years ago, roughly. Okay. And an amusing fact is that this was done before McKay and others did their map. The Hamiltonians were actually done before. So you take a family like this, and you increase beta. When beta is zero, you have the picture I showed before, or small. And as you increase, you know, notice that the golden invariant torus breaks up. That's a number beta infinity parameter value. And a little bit past there, the elliptic orbits, which I'm going to show in a slide afterwards, are also going to break up. And this happens at the parameter values beta n, and you form this asymptotic ratio, take the limit, and it converges to some number delta inverse. And you also, it's assuming n involved, yes?
So beta 1 gets a what?
Let's say where the principal elliptic orbits turn hyperbolic. But that happens, you can define them in various ways, so you can accumulate, but the simplest to visualize is when these elliptic orbits turn hyperbolic, and that happens after the torus breaks up. So after it breaks up, then the little guys start to break up. So, yeah, maybe I'll show it again on another. Okay, so or you could also define it in different ways. It's kind of like in Feigenbaum, you pick the 2 to the n period, and you fix some stability. You can take the point where it, where it bifurcates, or the point where it's superstable, or whatever, something of this sort. So you pick your favorite. Okay, and the scaling, the zooming in, is described by two numbers, and of course the whole deal is that this is universal, that you can take other families and observe the exact same numbers. So here is just what the critical thing looks like, another one of my slides, done with actually a critical Hamiltonian taking return maps. So So at exactly the critical point, you see self-similarity. You see a period 8, 13. These are the big blobs here. Then up here, you see 13, 21. And that's basically reflected and scaled by roughly 0.7 this way. Then you see the other three guys here, these three, then these three, then these three, and so forth. And then the picture stops. And this black curve here is the it's the section of the critical invariant torus. Okay, I'll have another picture of that torus, not just a section of it. But the explanation, of course, Escon and Dovey, and also for maps, others, Kononov, Schenker, McKay, looked for this type of explanation, namely, one would like to explain it that in the sense that in the space of Hamiltonians, you have some smooth manifold called sigma infinity. When you have a family passing through this at the intersection point is precisely when the torus breaks up. And that, in fact, the sigma infinity happens to be the stable manifold of a renormalization group X point. And that these other manifolds where the beta n's are when you go through, so when you bifurcate, are, of course, inverse images under the renormalization of sigma 1. And so they accumulate at the rate given by the expanding eigenvalue of this. And, of course, that cuts out here precisely parameter interval pieces of the shape I explained before, and that would explain everything if this picture was true. So the first thing is to find such a transformation, and it should map, of course, these guys into each other, and it should also involve some kind of a scaling, because after all, the sum of the universal number describes self-similarity. And so the Hamiltonian roughly has to be invariant under some kind of a scaling. And the eigenvalue lambda x I described before should be some eigenvalue of this thing here at some fixed point. Okay. So this is the desired explanation. Now, this is not all known to be true, but a little part of it is known to be true. And so here are some theorems. The first one is, indeed, there is such a transformation and a fixed point for it. The fixed point is Hamiltonian, the transformation is Hamiltonian, the transformation has a compact derivative, so it has discrete spectrum, finitely many outside the unit disk, the rest inside. It's not known at this moment if it's hyperbolic or not. Okay, so I'm not sure if it has eigenvalues on the unit disk or not. But I know, for example, that the eigenvalue here is non-trivial in the sense that it's, for smooth tori, it has to scale with theta to the minus 3. I mean, it's not a theorem, but, you can basically ignore this because in the theorem 2 is more precise. So this is like 3 or so years old, or 2 plus epsilon. And then there's some older numerical results where, in fact, this was implemented with just as a numerical algorithm where one could actually compute these numbers here to roughly the given accuracy. And they agree, by the way, with what McKay, of course, obtained. They are a little more precise, but otherwise, they agree, because one describes the same phenomenon except for the flows. So theorem 2 that's more recent is that these two estimates here are in fact correct. Estimates means that I don't know what the dots are. Okay, there are dots. I mean, could be anything. And in addition, every Hamiltonian on the strong local stable manifold of the non-trivial fixed point do have invariant tori that are not differentiable, golden invariant tori that are not differentiable. They're worse than not differentiable. They're not even Hölder continuous with exponent larger than some number that you can explicitly compute. And that's, again, that's the conjugacy. Okay, so as a surface, it may, of course, be C1 or more than C1, but probably not C2. But the conjugacy is not differentiable. So now I have to say a few words just about renormalization, and I make it as short as I possibly can, because, again, you probably have heard some of this already. So the one of the ingredients is, if you are interested in a frequency vector omega, you need to find some integer matrix whose transpose, star always stands for transpose for matrices, actually contracts the orthogonal complement. Okay, so in the case I gave before, this is obviously true because omega was an eigenvector of T, T was symmetric, so the orthogonal complement contracted. So out of this, imagine at the moment mu is 1, out of this you form this symplectic map when mu is 1, okay? And basically, it, you know, that was guessed already 25 years ago, the renormalization has to involve composing a Hamiltonian with this. So this is like stretching the torus in one direction and shrinking the other, and you know, so mapping it into itself. But it has, if numerically one can of course do this, but when you try to prove anything, you see that somehow this is a bad operation because the matrix has an expanding eigenvalue, and so you lose analyticity no matter what. So unlike other renormalization scheme, it's not just a contraction. You have a torus or a circle, you can't contract, so you have to do something. So let me quickly explain in three lines how to fix this problem or what to do about it. Mu is a number, yeah. Right now it's 1 at this moment, but eventually mu is going to be a number less than 1, and for the non-trivial case, it's a number close to theta to the minus 3, which is something like 0.2 or so. So it's a fairly small number. Imagine mu is a small number. Okay, so this involves the loss of analyticity, but this is not bad for all Hamiltonians. So I imagine a Hamiltonian to be decomposed into modes, okay, and I can think, try to figure out which modes are good and which modes are bad, in the sense that if I substitute, basically the bad thing is take this matrix, substitute it in here, and then you can take the transpose on the frequency, and you see for many, most frequency, the frequency gets longer if you do this. And so if you take as norm of this guy here, let's say e to a constant rho times the length of nu, then if the frequency expands, it's bad. If the frequency contracts, it's good. Here, again, this is not so crucial. So in fact, the good frequencies are the ones for which this contracts. Okay, so let me try to convince you that the good frequencies are in fact the ones that are resonant in this sense here. Okay, in the sense that the commutator with, or the Poisson bracket with the trivial Hamiltonian K here is small compared to the gradient. So this is normally what, when you do KM theory, these are the bad frequencies because these are the ones where you get small denominator and you have a hard time solving what some people call the homology equation or solving in first order what you need to make a change of value. So I claim these are actually, these are resonant, these are good here, okay. So what does it mean that this commutator is small compared to the gradient? That can happen in two ways. This is simply omega dot the gradient with respect to the angles of H. So this can be small if omega dot nu is small. Okay? This can be small if omega dot nu is small, meaning nu, the frequency of the mode, is roughly perpendicular to omega. The other way, this can be small compared to the gradient if the gradient is large. And one way the gradient is large is if there are huge powers of P. Okay, if the large powers of P, then the derivative is large because, for obvious reason. Okay, so we had just figured out that these are in fact, this implies this. Now I claim this implies that in fact when you compose this mode with T mu for a small mu, you actually get a small result, meaning that these are in fact the good modes for this primitive renormalization scheme. Well, if nu is roughly perpendicular to omega, you substitute here a T and then it goes over T star. In fact, everything that's perpendicular to omega gets contracted. Okay, so this is good. And P gets multiplied with a factor mu that's less than 1, so if alpha is large, you get also a small factor. So in both cases, in fact, a mode is contracted under this primitive operation precisely when the mode is somehow is resonant. Okay? And now, if it's not resonant, that's bad. You have to do something else. But notice, if it's not resonant, then this is a nice condition for making changes of variables. Okay, so the idea is now to define the renormalization in such a way that before you apply this operation, you make a change of variable that basically just gets rid of all non-resonant things. And by get rid of, I mean get rid of it completely. Okay, and the reason is because of this fact here, you can actually do it. You can do it in first order, and when you can do it in first order, you can do it in any order. I have it here more explicit, but let me just skip this. So this was for Hamiltonians. You can do, of course, the same thing for other vector fields. So here is just quickly a little lemma that shows that what you can do in first order, you can do in any order. So you take other vector fields, and so this is now what I mentioned, some ongoing joint project with Sasha Coxit, is renormalization of basically arbitrary vector fields in a such a way that if it's Hamiltonian, it stays Hamiltonian. If it's volume preserving, it stays volume preserving. It's some other symmetries. So the vector fields are roughly like this, and the renormalization is just instead of, you know, because now you don't have a Hamiltonian anymore, you have to take the pullbacks of these various things, and the definitions are precisely the same. So here basically what I call the non-resonance condition, that was the first line before, is basically a condition like this, that the commutator of two vector fields with that special one is larger or equal to a constant times the norm of the gradient. That's basically what this says. And the general lemma you can formulate, so the vector fields here are intended to be close to this, but the lemma is all general. The Z can be basically anything, everything can be anything. So you can see roughly that you have a theorem of the sort that if you have a vector field, then anything relatively nearby that does not commute too much with that vector field can be eliminated by a change of variables. That's what this says. Okay. And the change of variables is of the order of the size of what you're trying to eliminate. Okay. It's an interesting fact, maybe that's not noticed too often, but you take, for example, a vector field near here. Any vector field near here in the space A, let's say, in the space where you have analyticity here, any analytic vector field near this here actually is analytically conjugate to a vector field that has a significantly larger domain. Okay? So what I'm saying here about changes of variables is not taking one domain and deforming it in a slightly other one, okay? Theorem, basically, you take any analytic vector field near here. By analytic, you fix a strip and a disk is analytically conjugate to another one that has actually a significantly larger domain. Okay, this sounds a little bit like what one does in renormalization. You take some kind of weak form of conjugacy, you know, like a topological thing about circles, and you try to make it now a higher regularity and reduce it to linear rotation. Let's say you start with a rotation on a circle and you conjugate it to linear. Linear is analytic. So you actually prove that if you're, let's say, topologically conjugate and some decent rotation number, then you're actually conjugate to something analytic. So this is like some kind of a step in this direction. Okay, so the renormalization transformation involves a partial step in that direction. Okay, so let me quickly just mention some. So this is the end of just introduction to the renormalization transformation, but basically, the transformation on general vector fields I mentioned before preserves special types. is analytic, analyticity improving, and for those who want to quickly do the calculations in their head, the domain is roughly of the size of the matrix to the minus 2. This is important when you now try to do diophantine stuff where the matrix keep on changing. So if you have a cell similar frequency like the one I discussed before with the golden mean, then this is a fixed point and you have a stable manifold and you can do the usual. If it's diophantine, you actually take a sequence of transformations, each one adapted to the digits in the continued fraction expansion with the corresponding matrix. In higher dimension, you take the, for example, the multi-continued fractions expansion that Joao Lopez-Diaz was talking about earlier. And of course, there you need to know some bounds on the domain of your thing, so that the digits in the continued fraction expansion don't get large too fast, because otherwise, and that leads to diophantine conditions. It probably can be done more general. Okay, so let me now come to closer to the construction of invariant tori. The first ingredient you need is something like the stable manifold, and I'm going to go quickly through this. Unlike what you have like in circle maps or period doubling and so forth, you don't have necessarily an independent characterization of what it means to be infinitely renormalizable. You know, after all, you're trying to prove that there are, for example, invariant tori, so you can't use the existence of invariant tori to define what you mean by, you know, what you're trying to do. So not having an independent characterization, you really just have to go and prove the existence of a stable manifold. So let me just say a few words about it, because you need some little additional properties that one usually doesn't have. So I'm going to skip the technical slide that comes afterwards. But basically, there will be three basic rates of expansions or contractions under the renormalization. One is basically the directions which are relevant and are most expanding. This is the projection P. Then one really fast decaying rate is roughly functions that depend on the angle variables. These get contracted at a very fast rate by one step. Of course, it's not an invariant subspace, but in one step. And then the ones that have average zero get also contracted, but not so fast. So you have different speeds characterized by, let's say, different projections. And then for technical reason, it's convenient to put the domains of the renormalization to size order 1, and then modulo some very simple assumptions. Again, this is in all generality. You can prove something like this. So this is a necessary ingredient if you want to construct invariant tori. So notice we have a sequence of renormalization transformation, let's say, associated with continued fraction expansion. So you define the stable manifold the same way that you would for one map, namely anything that's mapped for the first transformation into the domain of the next, and then into the domain of the next. You take the intersection of all those things, and that's going to be, by definition, a stable manifold. You have to prove it's some kind of manifold. Here come the assumptions that I skipped, but basically under very mild assumptions, you can actually, and these are now sequences of transformations on some general Banach space, that you have two rates of convergence. One is basically for the stuff that's not in the expanding or most unstable direction, is with some number delta, let's say. And then the fast ones that go to zero with another rate, epsilon. So it's a slightly refined version of the usual, and it's proved the same way. It's the graph transform method, so you just assume whatever you have to assume to make this whole thing work. So it's not something difficult or anything. So this is another little lemma that's part of the work in progress with Sasha Kocsis for general vector fields, and this is just... Okay, the reason I actually write it down is that you actually need in the construction of invariant toroid that there is stuff that goes to zero faster than other things, because the change of variables are actually, if the function doesn't depend on angles, then there is no change of variables. Okay, the change of variables that was called UH at the beginning is actually the identity if the function doesn't depend on the angles. And so things that do depend on the angles that have zero torus average actually shrink at a faster rate. So the changes of variables go to the identity faster than you would expect normally at just looking at the rate of convergence to the trivial fixed point. So this gives you, this gives you pretty fast convergence. So now about the invariant toroid, here about the construction. So the construction used to be different, but this is now basically, when I tried to prove the existence of non-smooth invariant toroid, the old construction didn't work anymore because it was perturbation-based, and so something else had to be done. And there's actually a very natural thing of doing it. So this is just reminding you what the renormalization group is. We look, for simplicity, I'm looking at the very special setup. Okay, but you can ignore this. So I'm trying to solve this equation. This is the equation I'm trying to solve. Now, just from the renormalization form of the renormalization transformation, there's a very important identity, namely that the flow for the renormalized Hamiltonian or vector field is related to the flow of the original one by this semi-conjugacy, by the scaling that's involved in the definition. So basically, the flow for the rescaled Hamiltonian is trivially related to the flow for the original Hamiltonian. The time gets rescaled, and the rescaling here is trivial because of this simplifying assumption I made here, because I don't want to deal with the other thing here. So that's a trivial but very important identity. So now look at this following map. So a map, depending on the Hamiltonian H, that maps a function that goes from the trivial torus to the domain of the scaling. On one side, you take the inverse of the scaling in the trivial case, and on the other side, you take the scaling in the non-trivial case. If you put this over here, let's say you get something kind of like if these, okay, you get something like a semi-conjugacy, but I'll come back to this. So it turns out this is a nice operator to look at. And just from this identity here alone, you can basically get the following fact, that if gamma tilde is an invariant torus for the renormalized Hamiltonian, then M, the image under this map of gamma tilde, is an invariant torus for the original Hamiltonian. Okay? So in fact, if you know an invariant torus for the renormalized Hamiltonian, you get one for the original Hamiltonian. So it goes the opposite direction. And, okay, this is the change of variables that eliminates the non-resonant degrees of freedom at each step of the renormalization. And this is this trivial thing that just involves the matrices. Okay, so you can think this close to the identity just to get, for concreteness or so. Okay, so let's see how I can use this. How many minutes do I have? Oh, we still have like 15. Okay, great. So let's see how one uses this. So assume you have a fixed point I call H infinity that's on, and take a Hamiltonian on the stable manifold. So think of those as the infinitely renormalizable one. Then define the HNs to be the orbit of that H0 on the renormalization. So by definition, it goes into the fixed point. And then consider these tori. If I knew, for example, that this was a invariant torus for the Hamiltonian number n plus 1, I would know that gamma n is an invariant torus for the Hamiltonian hn. That was what I mentioned before. So if I very far in the chain, I knew that I had an invariant torus for a Hamiltonian pretty close to the fixed point, I can go back and get invariant tori this way for all the others. So the idea is now not, but I do not have any invariant toroid to begin with. So the idea is not to start with any, but just take these equations and just solve them and show that the results are actually invariant tori. So the construction is this. Prove that these guys are contractions. And this is pretty straightforward. Okay. Even in the non-trivial case, in the case of the, you know, the fixed point that I mentioned before, H star, show that they contract, but take a space of very low regularity. Reason being that there is an expansion here, there's a change of variable that's not homotopic to the identity that necessarily has to expand. So, but if you take, for example, on the space C0, then this makes no difference. Right, the soup norm is not affected by any change of variable. So basically only this enters, and this is, you can imagine, close to precisely this integer matrix business. So prove that this thing contracts, then once you have a sequence of contracting maps, you can construct a sequence of gamma n by a simple inverse limit. You start with anything you want and apply these guys. Since it contracts, it doesn't really depend on what you started out with, and so this converges to a limit. So now you have solutions for all these. The next step would basically to prove that these gammas are invariant tori. Well, there's an intermediate step. If your Hamiltonian is non-trivial and you don't know yet already it's invariant torus, you have to also construct the gamma infinity belonging to it. That you can either do by trying to take the limit of these gamma n's, but much more easily, just take the original Hamiltonian to be gamma, the fixed point Hamiltonian, because it lies also on the stable manifold. Go through this construction and you get this. So then it's very simple to show these guys are supposed to go to the invariant tori, sandwich in between the flow and the inverse of the trivial flow. Use what I called identity before to commute these guys in, and you get something of the form where you have a sequence of this map applied to this guy here. But as I said, this converges for anything, in quote, to the invariant torus. So as m goes to infinity, this converges to gamma n, and you got the proof, basically. So very simple. So that's the construction. A relatively simple construction of invariant tori by using this kind of maps MN. And this turns out to work also for to construct tori for Hamiltonians far from integral, because this M will be contracting. You have a lot. You have to be really an expert to get so bad bounds that you can't figure out that this thing contracts, basically. Okay. So first a word about constructing smooth tori. I mean, you may wonder why some are smooth and some others are not. I mean, how would I prove that? The deal is that this construction I just showed you produces, say, continuous tori, and now I have to prove that they're actually smoother than what it seems. So the first part only is bootstraps, basically another procedure that shows that it's smooth. So, and the idea is very simple. So the basic ingredient is that your fixed point Hamiltonian is invariant on the rotation of the torus, that the stable manifold is invariant on the rotation. This is not hard to check. I mean, because basically, well, you just look at the procedure, and if you do it halfway reasonable, then the renormal, you know, you first rotate Hamiltonian, then renormalize, or you first renormalize and then rotate. There has to be some obvious relation between the two. And since rotation with a real, okay, I stress here, real angle is an isometry, then obviously, you know, you're staying on the stable manifold if you were on the stable manifold before. You need an analytic stable manifold, and you also need that the map that takes the Hamiltonian H0 to its invariant torus is also analytic. Once you have this, and then you have another identity, which in fact is also pretty easy to understand, that if you have one Hamiltonian construct its invariant torus, then you rotate this Hamiltonian, construct invariant torus of the rotated Hamiltonian, then the two tori are also related by a rotation. Okay, you simply check that your construction satisfies this. So you have some kind of semi-conjugacy or some kind of whatever one calls such a relation between the invariant torus of the rotated Hamiltonian, the original one. Now this is true for real rotations, but now notice that if you only knew that this here is actually continuous, if you evaluate the left-hand side at zero, because there's a translation, well, you get the value of the torus at x. Okay? Well, the right-hand side, though, is analytic in x. Because take your Hamiltonian to be slightly bigger domain of analyticity, then this family is an analytic family. Okay? And since gamma depends analytically on the Hamiltonian, this is analytic and everything on the right is analytic in x. And since it's the same for real x, you actually have an analytic extension. So the invariant tori are analytic. Okay. I should have covered some things here so you wouldn't see this right away. But you may have wondered, first of all, there is no talk ever of non-degeneracy condition. There are no non-degeneracy condition in this whole game. Then, but you also wonder, why can I only construct invariant tori for Hamiltonians on the stable manifold? Well, these two questions come together in this picture. If you actually have a non-degenerate Hamiltonian not on the stable manifold, and you look at the set of all its translates, if you take a Hamiltonian close enough to the stable manifold, it intersects it in a dimension one line, and so constructing an invariant torus for the translated Hamiltonian gives you obviously an invariant torus for the original one. So this is how non-degeneracy comes in. But the two things are separated in this approach that... Okay, so now let's come to the critical tori. Okay, you still have, what, 5 minutes? Okay. Maybe I'll speed up a bit. So, the critical tori... I have the advantage of looking at a special set of Hamiltonians that, first of all, has a symmetry, is even in the angles, but then it actually depends non-trivially only on a special combination of the momenta, and as an effect is that, in fact, this quantity here is invariant under the flow. So you can call this time, therefore. No, this is actually not true. The derivative is not zero. It's one or some constant. It's constant, the derivative. So I think of this thing as time. As a result, because of this special time-preserving Hamiltonians, the changes of variables and the expected invariant torus, you can look in them, you can search for them in a space where the component in the direction of omega in the angles is actually trivial. Okay. The end effect is now the following. So now if I keep ignoring this and I try to solve this equation, notice that this is basically this linear transformation times something that's not too far away from the identity. I mean, you would have to be really far away from the identity to mess up the nice property of this. Now this thing here, you can ignore the p variables because mu is small. Okay? The q variables, t has an expanding direction, but I just said this expanding direction is in fact trivial, so I can ignore it, and the other direction is contracting by a factor 1 over the golden mean. So you have to do really bad thing to mess this up. So even in the non-trivial case, this thing is contracting so nicely that you can use it to construct invariant tori. So here is what one needs to prove, basically, to get things started. First, one has to prove the existence of a non-trivial fixed point. This was a computer-assisted proof like 3 years or something ago. So I can't really go into this. There's not enough time. As a corollary, so to say, you get this identity that I wrote down before. It also implies something that I wrote here, but there's not enough time to elaborate on that. But the invariant torus, the critical invariant torus, is in fact, turns out to be the stable manifold of the scaling map, okay? And at the same time, the closure of an unstable manifold, of a one-dimensional unstable manifold, which I'm trying to explain here, but you can ignore this. So this thing that is non-smooth is actually is a stable manifold. No, and they are often not smooth. Right? I mean, more often than not. Okay, so one needs first a non-trivial fixed point. Second, one needs bounds on the scaling associated with a non-trivial fixed point. And this is again part of a computer assisted proof to get some very primitive bounds on the scaling involved that imply in fact that MH is a contraction. So therefore you have a fixed point of M, and this is just a fixed point property written in a different way. And then you take this and this, and you conclude that the fixed point of this map is in fact an invariant torus of the Hamiltonian. So here you are, you have already invariant tori. You also have the invariant tori gamma n now for points on the stable manifold for the exact same reason. If this is a contraction with this scaling, then any nearby thing, it will still be a contraction. Okay. The other ingredient you need is you need a bound on the eigenvalue, on one of the eigenvalues of this derivative here of the scaling. Okay? And here, you do also part of the computer-assisted proof, you need some bound on this. Well, the bound just has to be good enough to show that it's not minus the inverse golden mean, and in fact, you need that it's larger. It's a curious thing. Those who know statistical mechanics and so forth about anomalous dimensions and stuff, this will look familiar that it's rather larger than smaller. Okay? For some reason, I don't understand, this always happens. And in fact, it's crucial here. Okay? I have no clue why it's always so favorable. Here, by the way, one has to prove this is a contraction here, near, not of course not globally, but near some approximately constructed invariant torus. Here is a picture of the approximately constructed invariant torus. Okay, so this is the critical invariant torus. Doesn't look very critical, but okay. So, I mean, this is maybe close to C2 or something as a surface. Okay, but what of course is the problem that if you look at the conjugacy, so if you looked at the squares of the sizes, they will get, you know, the ratios of sizes of these squares and will actually diverge if you take the limit of smaller and smaller squares. Okay? Nice surface. So here is a rough idea, and that's basically my last slide. So I'm on time. It's almost as if I planned it. Okay, here is the rough idea. Okay, it doesn't take rocket science to develop an attack to this problem of, okay, I'm sure others have thought of that too. So here is your invariant torus, and by the equation it satisfies, it actually semi-conjugates a trivial picture with a non-trivial picture. So the flow here over here is semi-conjugate to the flow of the real thing. The matrix T is semi-conjugate to the scaling over here. And so basically this here is the whole picture. So this is the fixed point of T, which is zero. This is the image of this zero under gamma is a fixed point of the scaling. And the idea is to capitalize on the fact that there is an eigenvector with an eigenvalue that's different here and here. Okay, so here you have minus theta inverse. In this direction of the flow, the two eigenvalues are the same. Because as I said, the renormalization of time is trivial, so in fact, the speed here is preserved. And everything is smooth, by the way, in this direction, as you can see. But this direction here, you have an eigenvalue minus theta inverse, and here you have an eigenvalue lambda x, and they are not the same. Okay, so this obviously seems incompatible with having a smooth semi-conjugacy between the two. Okay, well, almost true, unless the derivative of this at this point happens to be zero. Okay, this is really annoying because I don't really know much about this thing here, so it would be hard to check that the derivative is not zero, especially if it's not, if you don't really believe it's differentiable in the first place. So you have to do slightly different story. For the fixed point, you could use some general theorems and some this and that to actually get away with this picture here. But the thing is, I need it not just for the fixed point, for other Hamiltonians on the stable manifold. So what one actually does is, and this is very rough only, is in fact one tries to prove that these guys are invertible near the torus, and one inverts the whole thing. So gamma zero is the invariant torus for the original Hamiltonian I start out with, and I already constructed them. The point is only to show that they are not smooth. And then they get me via the inverses of this to an invariant torus for a Hamiltonian very, very close to the non-trivial fixed point. So I have to prove that this makes sense. And once it makes sense, I evaluate this on a sequence of points that get closer and closer to zero here. Okay? Now notice that in this direction, the matrix T, so this is just our original identity. So T to the n shrinks this by minus theta inverse to the n. So this is a rate that the inverse golden mean, this goes to zero. Then if this guy here was differentiable, then after composing with this, it would shrink at the same rate. Okay? But now look at these guys. They expand with a number that's strictly less than the inverse of this. Okay? So if you have a long chain of this and a long chain of this, the end effect is that for large n, this thing actually goes just plain to zero. Okay? So here you have, in fact, a function that's identity periodic that just goes to zero, but notice that these guys here, this is an irrational rotation on the torus. So S can be any number. This is a dense set of points. So for a dense set of points, you go to zero, but we know the torus is continuous. We know that much. So therefore, there you have a contradiction. Okay. So, well, obviously, this doesn't just prove it's not C1, but it proves that you can't even be Hölder with the appropriate index computed from these two eigenvalues. And this is not just at zero, but at the dense set of points, because now you can carry it all over the torus that you want. Okay, so basically, technically, the computer-assisted part basically gives you, you need that these two guys are, this inequality is the main thing you have to verify besides constructing the invariant fixed point. The other stuff is more like hand-assisted. You don't need the computer, but you have to do certain things. You have to linearize these guys because, you know, obviously there are expanding direction here. You have to show that they'll get it into the way of the others. So that's basically it, the idea in how to construct these non-differentiable invariant tori. Okay, thank you.